Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Back on the Osprey, Teska and his fellow captives are waiting for their opportunity to escape. Chapter 12. The blades of the Agentis were a whirling blur as he closed with Teska, but Teska met the assault with perfect calm. Thorn among petals, he thought, recognizing the classic move. Every attack but one is a feint, meant to distract the opponent, leaving them open to the true strike. It was said that a true master of the technique would himself not know which strike was the true one until the moment he delivered it, giving nothing away. Teska, however, did not think the man facing him was a true master of thorn among petals, and saw the strike coming, neatly spinning aside as the man's argument extended past him. Teska flicked his retort towards the outstretched arm, but he did not fully commit to the attack. There was something about his opponent's posture, a flicker of hesitation, that made him hold back, sensing yet another feint. His suspicions proved correct. The Agentis twisted in response to Teska's move, but because Teska did not fully commit to his attack, the man's counterstrike failed to land. In one final exchange of blades, the two whirled away from each other, each putting their backs to the walls surrounding the pit. The Agentis paused and crossed his blades in front of him. Teska immediately did the same and stood at ease. The Agentis smiled in appreciation.
"I commend you, Lorenus. You have trained him well." "Well enough," Teska's master replied from the top of the pit. "There is yet work ahead." "True, but he remains clear-headed in the midst of battle. He sees beyond the first deception. Does he see through the second and third?"
"At times, when he is focused."
Teska kept his eyes downcast to the sand, remaining silent. He was not permitted to address anyone without Lorenus's permission.
"He is taller than some other northerners I have met," the Agentis went on. "That leaves him hardly shorter than the average member of the nobility." He grinned. "And his reaction time, very impressive. What is your secret, Lorenus? Do you require your pupils to catch fish with their bare hands for supper? Hunger is a powerful motivator."
"Not powerful enough," Lorenus said. "I have my students stand upon a single board laid across a pool of oil. Then I flick lit matches at them. They learn to catch them all very quickly."
The Agentis raised his head to regard Lorenus, surprised. Then when he saw the sly smile on the older man's face, he began to laugh. Lorenus joined in, enjoying his friend's reaction.
"Villain, you know I don't share my techniques with anyone, so stop prying." "Still can't catch you in a lie unless you let me," Villain said, still laughing.
He sheathed his weapons and nodded to Teska, who did the same. Then Valan hauled himself up to the top of the stone wall to stand beside Lorenus.
"I've never understood how you managed to do that."
"A variation of the promise," Lorenus replied. "I have explained to you my interpretation of the tale of Dracus many times, and yet you fail to grasp the concept."
"Dracus again," Valan said with a good-natured sigh.
He looked at Teska.
"Required reading for you, I expect."
Teska glanced at Lorenus, who nodded. "Yes, Dignity, I have read the tale many times."
"A legend," Villon replied, giving Lorenus an amused glance.
"If I may, Dignity, we do not consider it a legend, but a true story."
Villon laughed.
"Spoken like a proper minor of Lorenus. Dracus defended his master against 100 men, dispersing them without needing to draw his blades, and you believe that to be a true story. What lesson do you draw from it?"
"Dracus stood before the 100 and told them that if one man stepped forward, if one man drew his weapon, then Dracus would first kill that man, then the entire 100, Teska told him. "That was his promise to them. The lesson is that Dracus believed his promise so strongly, so completely, that the 100 also believed it."
Velan looked skeptical.
"One man against 100. A tall order, even for the greatest of Agenti. Now, in the right location, with the right circumstances, it might be possible. Perhaps Dracus held a narrow defile, and so would only have to face a handful at any one time. But the tale says nothing of the terrain, so many believe it to be a legend, something that has grown in the telling. Facing down 10 men does not sound so impressive as 100.
Dignity, if one's belief is powerful enough, one may convince another of anything, Tesca replied.
Velan sighed and was about to speak when Tesca felt a nudge at his arm.
The sun beset, Windmaster.
Thank you, Giacomo, Tesca said, opening his eyes, the torchlit sparring pit fading back into his memories. The only light there was to see by was the light of a small lamp shining down through the hatchway into their cramped space. The additional reflected light from outside that had managed to get this far down during the day was gone. He leaned forward, his ribs still throbbing from Ambrose's beating.
No sign of our friend yet?
No, murmured Cédouin, huddled in a corner of his cell, the deep shadows making his face seem exaggerated and twisted, like a puppeteer's carved caricature. Only the glitter of his eyes and the dim light made him come alive.
Dibby sounds all afternoon around the hull, Giacomo commented, but all be quiet now.
That was the crew setting up Kern's defenses against armorbacks, Tesca said. Have you ever had to do that?
No, Giacomo replied, chuckling. Giacomo never be on a ship stupid enough to be anchoring above them. But he be seeing ships like that before. Be looking like pufferfish, nah?
Tesca nodded. The spikes keep the armorbacks from climbing aboard. At least, that's what I've heard. But do they really work?
For the smaller creatures, perhaps, Cédouin offered, unless they are very hungry.
He shook his head.
The larger ones, however, can leap directly from the water to a deck as high as this one. That I have seen for myself.
He noticed both men were looking at him, and he chuckled.
I have captained several incarnations of the Le Rouge. One of them was roughly the size of this ship. The Malacans had laid a trap for me off the western coast of the Broken Lands, but they mistimed their attack, and I slipped the noose. Fleeing pursuit, shortly after nightfall, I brought the ship into a small cove I knew. The intention was to wait for our pursuit to pass by and move on at dawn. All at once, the water around us erupted as armorbacks came bounding aboard. The cove had become a nest for them since my last visit. Thank the daughter, it was a small nest. There were not enough of them to overwhelm us before we were able to escape back into the deep ocean. I decided my chances were better against the Royal Navy.
He smiled as Giacomo laughed quietly.
With armorbacks, mes amis, it all depends on their numbers and their hunger. If both are in strong supply, then nothing will stop them. Certainly not a collection of spike-laced nets hanging down the sides of your ship. The only effective defense against them is to keep moving. Lying quiet and dark like this, attempting to masquerade as the water itself, that is a distant second choice.
He sighed.
Ironically, if the creatures do attack the ship, we are likely the safest of all, tucked away down here.
But you're still willing to try getting off this ship tonight?
Cédouin nodded. For the same reason you are, monsieur. The armorbacks are an unknown quantity. Their numbers and their hunger are variables. They might attack the ship. They might drag us below to feast upon our flesh. But le Dauphin Fain, it is a certainty what he will do to us. Given such options, I will always roll the dice. Besides, I am curious what our little friend has in mind for escape.
Tesca let himself sink back into a half-alert drowse, his eyes closed, focusing only on what he could hear. It was clear that Kern, as part of his procedure for tonight's defense, had forbidden all unnecessary sounds. There was no music, no sound of conversation, and no ringing of the bell signaling the change of watch. This made it hard for Tesca to keep track of time, but not impossible. Even without the bells, the ship's routine continued. The change of watch was now being passed by word of mouth. He began to anticipate these quiet changes, sensing a faint increase in the background noise of the ship as small groups of men headed on deck, exchanging places with the previous watch, who came down the ladder and climbed into the now empty bunks. Most of the crew was sleeping or staying quiet. He turned his head, hearing Valon chuckle.
"There's a difference between the promise and what that old Malacan was talking about, young man," the Agentis said, looking down at Tesca from the top of the pit. "Do you see it?"
"Yes," Tesca replied, dimly aware that he had fallen asleep again. Cédouin looks past deception to see what a man truly believes. There is no deception in the promise. Velan sighed. Internalization of belief. No one else follows the Draken interpretation of the promise more strictly than Lorenus. Young man, the promise is a hallmark of the Agenti. It identifies us to others as often as the blades we bear. You are aware that there are other schools of thought with regard to the promise.
Yes, Dignity, Teska replied. The Olivius school, for example, stresses the shaping of the promise to external factors. If one is facing a Dejanim tribesman, then the promise should somehow involve his braid of adulthood, perhaps stating that one will cut it off and wear it as a belt after killing him, or even that he will be strangled to death with the braid itself as a threat of ultimate disgrace. Villon's lip curled in a faint smile.
Unsubtle examples, but I take your point. Why do you not follow this school?
The purpose of the promise is to avoid combat which does not serve the master's interests. The Agentius has more important things to do than kill this particular opponent. He must save his strength for a more crucial task ahead. The promise is meant to remove this obstacle in the most efficient manner possible. In the case of the Dejanim, such a promise could instead drive the man to attack. But, moving from specifics to a general argument, the weakness of the Olivius school is that the Agentis must know the target extremely well to tailor the promise to him. It is likely that in the course of our duties, we will encounter many opponents we have never met, and we will have but a single moment to deliver the promise. Devising a promise in that moment, based on circumstantial observation, is ultimately guesswork, inefficient and imprecise. The Draken school, as you call it, seizes upon that moment and strips away all external concerns. The primary factor in making the promise is the only one that we have complete control over, our own belief.
Velan mulled this over. Still, one man threatening 100 with death, I find it hard to imagine any Agentis believing that they could accomplish such a task.
He did not threaten 100 men with death, Teska said with a smile. He threatened one man with death 100 times. Let us imagine a lone man, armed with a pistol, being confronted by 2 swordsmen seeking his death. One of the swordsmen tells him, "You have 1 shot. You can only kill one of us before the other reaches you."
"Yes, but which of you will it be?" the gunman asks.
Velan laughed, and Teska went on.
"I agree, Dignity, that if the 100 attacked, Drakus would not have survived. Everyone there knew that, including Drakus. His promise was a boast, a lie, and this was the point I could not grasp. I could not understand how Drakus had made it work until my fraternagentes, Titus Satax, said one thing to me. Tell the truth, even when you lie. Then it all became clear. Where is the truth? It is in the first half of Drakus's promise. He would kill the first man to step forward, and that was something each of the 100 could very easily believe.
Velan slapped his thigh, roaring with laughter.
Tell the truth, even when you lie. That is a defense of the Draken school I've not heard before. Leave it to Titus Satax to come up with it. Word or blade, no one else strikes to the heart with such precision.
He glanced at Lorenus.
Where is that rascal?
Gone these 3 years, Lorenus replied. There was nothing more he could learn from me.
Velan's smile slipped, catching something in the older man's tone or phrasing that Teska did not fully grasp.
I see. But he has found a master, of course. There were many who had expressed an interest in recruiting him.
There were, Lorenus agreed, and he has. No doubt he serves that master with his customary distinction.
He broke off, looking up at the ceiling, and then Teska heard it too, a quiet shuffling of footsteps on the upper decks, a change in the Osprey's watch.
We may discuss that another time.
The high rafters above the training pit shifted into the low deck above their cages as Teska forced himself out of his doze.
Did I sleep through a shift in watch? He asked Giacomo. No, Windmaster. Last watch before dawn.
Then if Yvette is going to make her move, it's going to be now. He could hear a new sound mixed in with the background noise of the ship, a man snoring, close at hand, and he realized that it was the guard Ambrose had set by the open hatchway. Then he heard another sound, a faint creak of deck just above them. Footfall, he thought,
turning to glance at his companions. Both of them were awake, crouched on the balls of their feet, waiting. Another footfall, someone crossing the deck above them. Then the snoring abruptly cut off, replaced by a brief struggle and the sound of something falling to the deck. A moment later, Yvette was slipping down the ladder and coming towards them.
"We have to move quickly," she said in a low voice, producing a set of keys and unlocking the cages. "But first, we have to put this on."
She took out a small flask, uncorked it, and poured a quantity of liquid onto her hands. Then she rubbed them across her shirt, down her torso, and over her legs. The scent was acrid, a sharp, bitter tang that seared the nostrils. Yvette coughed quietly, then handed the flask to Tesca.
"Divide that among the three of you. Put it on your clothes. Use every drop."
Tesca poured a quantity into his hands and repeated what Yvette had done.
"What is it?"
"Amabak musk," Sidois answered, recognizing the smell. "At least that's what it's called. Triad only knows what it's really made of, but the scent is supposed to keep Amabaks away."
"Exactly," Yvette replied. "Either they think you're one of them, or they think you're not worth eating. I don't really care which it is, so long as it works."
Tesca felt the palms of his hands starting to itch, as well as places on his body where the liquid had gotten through holes in his clothing.
"Is this stuff poisonous?"
"Not fatally," she assured him, "unless you drink it. It's meant to go on the nets that hang over the side. Just try not to let it touch too much of your bare skin."
"I am filled with optimism for our success," Sidois commented, taking the flask from Tesca.
"I'm improvising," Yvette snapped. "I just hope there's enough there for all of us to be protected. I only filled the one flask. I didn't expect to be leaving with this many."
"It'll have to do," Tesca commented as Giacomo snatched the flask away from Sidois before the pirate could use a second application of the noxious substance for himself. The islander finished the bottle, then ran his hands through the ends of his dreadlocks to get the last of the substance off his palms. Tesca looked back at Yvette. "Now what?"
"Now we get up on deck before the change in watch is over," the girl replied. "There's no light allowed up there, so a few extra shadowy figures mixed in with the others shouldn't draw attention."
"Then what?" Sidois asked, looking suspicious.
Yvette smiled.
"After Andros ordered the captain to stay out here in the bay, Kern readied the gig to be put into the water at a moment's notice, in case he needed to send someone into my port for supplies."
"How convenient of Kern to do that," Tesca commented. "Did his cabin boy perhaps make an innocent suggestion or two that led him to give such an order?" Yvette's smile widened.
"As exciting as it is for us to watch you two exchanging secrets of the guild," Sidois cut in, "then perhaps you might realize that even in the darkness, the crew will not fail to notice four sailors making off with the gig."
"I've arranged a bit of a diversion," Yvette replied, "so we have to get moving. It won't do us any good if we're down here when it happens."
"What's the diversion?" Tesca asked.
"You'll know it when you see it. Just head for the gig," she threw back as she turned towards the ladder. "It's set up on the port side."
As she led them up the ladder and out of the hold, they passed the sentry Andros had set over them. Sidois made a quiet compliment to Yvette in Malakin on the single stab wound in the man's back, to which the blonde spy shrugged. The sound of sailors moving about was louder now, just one deck above them.
"Keep your heads down and out of the light," Yvette said to them as she reached another ladder and started climbing.
Tesca followed her and found himself among the crew's bunks. There was only one lamp lit, turned down low, on the far side of the space. Numerous hammocks, most of them occupied by sleeping sailors, broke up the light into shifting shadows, so Tesca had no trouble slipping into the procession of sailors padding up the next ladder to the main deck. It was a clear night, with only a mild breeze. The moon was three quarters full, bathing the deck in soft, silver light. A man, Tesca thought it might be the ship's bosun, was standing at the top of the ladder. He pushed a long pole into Tesca's hands, then with a series of quick gestures, indicated that Tesca should move to the starboard rail and keep watch out on the water. Tesca nodded and moved off, glancing over his shoulder to pinpoint the location of his fellow escapees. Giacomo was moving to the port rail, Sidois next to him. Yvette was already lost among the larger silhouettes on deck. The sounds of Myporian nightlife floated to them from across the bay, but on the starboard side, Tesca's back was to the city. He leaned over the rail to look at the nets hanging down to the water. At every knot of ropes, each perhaps a foot span apart, a sharpened wooden stake had been weaved into it, the point angling down towards the water. With dozens of stakes bristling out from the ship, Giacomo's comparison of the ship to a puffer fish was very apt. Tesca could see that climbing through all that would be difficult for a man, but he wondered how much it would slow down an armorback.
"Sun's wrath, but you don't have stink," muttered the sailor next to him.
There came a grunt of alarm from the bosun, who stormed up to the sailor.
"No talking, no noise," he hissed, his voice barely above a whisper. "One more sound out of either of you and you're going over the side."
He glanced towards Tesca, and although he didn't say anything, Tesca could see his nose wrinkling in the moonlight. Tesca's own nostrils were so full of the smell that he hadn't realized that it was only coming from him. If the nets are supposed to be coated with the musk as well, he realized, I shouldn't be the only thing smelling this bad. Suspicious, he put his hand on one of the nets. It was wet, but the liquid did not make his skin itch as it had when he'd used Yvette's flask, and with grim respect, he began to get an idea of what Yvette's plan was. He glanced around, looking for her. The bosun shoved him.
"Eyes on the water," he hissed. "Only call out if you see anything moving down there."
Tesca nodded and turned back to the rail. He watched the motion of the water, the gentle waves lapping against the hull. Then he noticed a small set of ripples to his right, disturbing the smooth flow of light and shadow. Squinting, he saw something bobbing in the water, just a foot away from the hull. He drew a breath to call out when he saw a thin black line leading up from the object to the rail. A small figure, barely visible in the darkness, finished lowering the object into the water, then let go of the line. Tesca had only a moment to see a glimpse of white feathers in the moonlight before the object sank silently beneath the waves. The figure slipped away from the rail, and Tesca knew he dare not turn his head to continue watching. He'd earned the bosun's wrath twice so far. He didn't want to push his luck. That had to be Yvette, he thought, lowering a fresh chicken into the water. He took a long, slow breath, now certain what Yvette's plan was. No repellent on the nets and dropping bait? A shame a grant there was enough musk in that flask for all four of us. He heard a footstep behind him.
Nearly through the night, sir, the bosun whispered.
It's not over yet, Mr. Peller, came Captain Curran's reply. Dawn is still a few hours off. You'll treat this watch as if it was the first one. No slip-ups, no lax behavior.
Aye, sir.
At that moment, there was a noise in the rigging, and everyone on deck whipped their heads up to look. There was a sputtering of red-orange sparks coming from a portion of the furled mainsail. In the near darkness, the glow from the sparks stood out like a flare. Then the sparks ignited some small package set into the folds of the sail, and all at once, the deck of the Osprey was bathed in firelight as the package exploded, pieces of flaming debris falling to deck, burning to ash, while others landed on other portions of the sail, spreading the fire.
"Wave and wind," muttered a voice near him.
Tesca looked around to see the entire watch, over a dozen faces staring up at the fire, their faces slack with shock and dread. Kern, who was standing close by, noticed the movement and looked Tesca full in the face. An instant later, his eyes flared open in recognition.
"You," he grated.
He might have said more, but then there came the sound of a splash, starboard side aft, close to where Yvette had dropped her bait. An instant later, something large landed on the rail of the ship in a shower of water. Tesca only had time to see glistening carapace reflecting the light of fire and moon before the creature pulled the closest sailor into its embrace with several segmented limbs, then fell back into the bay, taking its prize with it. The hapless man was only able to utter a single yelp of surprise before he was gone. Chaos erupted on deck. Men ordered to silence gave shouts of alarm as the waters around the Osprey suddenly boiled with movement, over a dozen forms launching themselves towards the ship. Many of them landed in the nets, squealing and shrieking as the wooden spikes jabbed into their underbellies. Some of these fell back into the water, but others clung on and struggled to climb up to the deck, the spikes impeding their progress. The sailors, calling out as they identified the armorback's positions, leaned over the rail and drove their poles down into the scrabbling creatures, desperately trying to knock them back into the water. But, as Sidois had predicted,
only the smaller creatures were halted by the nets. The three largest bounded over the railing, landing on the deck and scuttling towards the closest sailors. Their resemblance to lobsters was very strong, especially in the front half of their bodies. Each of them was close to 7 feet long and well over 2 feet wide where the legs sprouted from their middles. They stayed low, keeping their underbellies close to the deck, their tails lifted high. The one closest to Teska turned toward him. Two long eye stalks, extending out from beneath the slender armored taper around the creature's head, moved back and forth independently of each other. Below the eyes was a dark space, but Teska could see movement there, wispy protuberances flicking in and out like a crab's mouth. It had 6 limbs, 4 of which it used to propel itself along the deck, its spiked feet digging into the wood. The 2 forelimbs were longer, ending in pincers. Proportionally, they were not so large as a lobster's claws, but at this size, they could still easily crush a man's arm or leg. The tail was thick and powerful, but unlike a lobster's tail, it could flex both up and down, reminding Teska of a dolphin, albeit with sections of armor plates set into it. The creature sprang forward, and Teska barely had a chance to get his pole up before it was on him. The pincers grasped the pole, and Teska felt it being pulled from his hands with appalling ease. Then suddenly, the creature let go of the pole and turned from Teska, ignoring him completely. Teska had no time to wonder at this before the armorback charged Captain Kern. Kern's eyes were wide with fear, but his hand never wavered as he raised his pistol and pulled the trigger. There was a pop, and a swirl of purple smoke curled out of the barrel. Kern's face twisted, and he gave a wordless yell of frustration as the armorback came on, rising up to encircle the captain in 4 of its limbs. Teska jabbed his pole into the armorback's side, putting all his strength into it, and the creature gave a shriek in protest, but it did not let go of its prize. Teska followed as it raced across the deck, carrying Kern with it, jabbing furiously with his pole. But a moment later, the creature reached the opposite rail and tumbled over the side. In one frozen moment, Teska met Kern's desperate, pleading gaze. Then the captain was gone. Pale with horror, Teska turned away from the rail. He ran to join Giacomo and Sidois, who were already at work preparing the gig for launch.
"I see the musk works," Sidois said with a sly grin, jerking his head towards the railing where the armorback had taken Kern into the bay.
"It works," Teska agreed. His voice was level, flat, but some part of him knew that last look on Kern's face would haunt him for the rest of his days. As Yvette had predicted, none of the crew had any opportunity to object to what they were doing, much less even notice in the confusion. Several of the smaller armorbacks had managed to climb up to the rails and were hauling themselves onto the deck, but there were more sailors coming up from below decks as well. One of the other 2 large armorbacks that had leapt onto the deck was now falling back into the sea, taking a sailor with it. The last one had been encircled by 3 sailors, who jabbed at it with their poles. The creature chattered and squealed at them, circling around and around. Then, with a yell of fury, a 4th man raced forward when the creature had its back to him. He leapt into the air, bringing a long wooden mallet down with both hands. There was a loud crack and a shriek of pain from the monster, and its legs buckled. The man raised the mallet again, this time bringing it down on the creature's head. The armorback flailed once more and then went still, save for 1 twitching leg.
"Get the hammers!"
the man roared to the astonished cheers of the sailors around him, and Teska recognized Garrick Cabot's voice.
"Crack 'em open!"
"I believe that is our cue to depart," Sidois said dryly as the 3 men extended the wooden cradle holding the gig out over the side. Then they untied the ropes securing the gig to the cradle, and working in tandem, Teska and Giacomo each held 1 of the guide ropes and lowered the gig down towards the water. Teska risked a glance over his shoulder as the battle moved into a full melee, men and armorbacks now crowding the deck.
"Where's Yvette?" he asked.
"We cannot wait for her," Sidois said.
"We no believe in her here," Giacomo shouted.
Sidois rolled his eyes. "She would not extend that courtesy to you, whale hunter. That cochon who hates the left hand is making a good show against the armorbacks. The sailors are inspired by his example. We are running out of time. Perhaps she has already been carried off by an armorback. Did you consider that?"
"Thankfully, monsieur, that did not happen," Yvette said, suddenly among them.
she had a thick pile of unorganized papers in her hand, which she stuffed into a leather satchel over her shoulder.
But thank you so much for waiting for me.
Ah, mademoiselle, the pirate said with apparent delight. The triad smiles upon us by gracing us with your presence once more.
Yvette sighed as she buckled her satchel closed. Took a trip to Ambrose's cabin? Tesca asked her.
Last chance I'm likely to have, she laughed.
The smile froze on her face as she saw the battle raging across the deck. Now that the crew was engaged with the armorbacks, there were fewer men guarding the rails, and more of the creatures were coming over the sides, replacing those who had been able to grab a sailor and take him into the water with them. But the sailors were giving as good as they got. Garrick's call for hammers had been taken up as a battle cry, and those sailors now racing on deck were carrying mallets, hammers, boarding axes, lengths of lumber, anything that might crack through the attacker's carapace. Their strategy was simple. Individual armor backs were surrounded and menaced on all sides, then one sailor would dart in and try to strike a crushing blow when its attention was diverted. When the tactic worked, an armor back was quickly crippled and brought down. When it didn't, when the armor back could turn in time to intercept the attack, the monster's pincers often took the man's arm, or sometimes head, clean off with one strike. The deck was awash with gore, blood, and a translucent ichor that was leaking from dead armor backs. A good diversion, Tesca said to her, breaking her out of her stricken reverie. Let's not waste it. She nodded and took one of the two ropes that led down to the gig. Giacomo, Tesca ordered, you take the other rope. Get the oar set up and be ready to cast off once we're all aboard. Giacomo nodded and started down at once. Tesca looked at Citoyen. Can you climb with one hand?
Down is easier than up, the Malecan chuckled, taking the rope and starting after Giacomo.
He moved more slowly than the islander, twining his left arm around the rope, alternatively squeezing it against his body and releasing it, and using his right hand to steady his progress. Tesca reached for the rope and was about to start down himself when he heard movement close to him and whirled away. The heavy mallet smashed into the gig's cradle.
Get him, Will! Garrick Cabot yelled. Flank him!
Tesca leapt forward, tackling Cabot before the smuggler could ready his hammer again, and the two men rolled across the deck. Tesca was able to knock the hammer out of Cabot's hands, and he locked his own hands around Cabot's throat. But after the past few days, his strength was only a shadow of its former self, and Cabot was able to break Tesca's grip and fling him off. The two men scrambled to their feet, Cabot drawing a knife. He grinned at Tesca, his face bright and animate.
We'll get him, Will! We'll get him!
Tesca backed away, and Cabot followed. Then to his left, he saw another armor back coming over the rail, and suddenly, he had an idea. He waited until the creature had gotten over the rail, then feinted to his right, throwing Cabot off guard. An instant later, he ran left, straight towards the armor back. The creature reared up and opened its limbs to him, having no objection to hunting prey that ran straight into its embrace. But just as the armor back's arms closed about him, suddenly it shivered and let go, even lifting itself higher on its back legs to get some distance from him. Tesca dropped down and slid through the filth on the deck, going underneath the armor back and popping up behind it. The armor back didn't even turn to regard him, acting as if Tesca had never been there. Instead, it charged towards the new target directly in front of it. Garrick howled in wordless rage as the creature came at him, but his eyes were still only on Tesca. Tesca grabbed one of the ropes that led down to the gig as he swung his legs over the rail, and with a grin, he turned back to look at Cabot. That was his mistake. Cabot had enough time to throw his knife before the armor back fell upon him. It flashed through the air as Tesca turned, catching him in the abdomen. Pain exploded through him, and a red haze filled his vision as he watched the armor back try to haul Cabot away. But this was a smaller one than the monster that had taken Kern, and Cabot was not paralyzed with fear. With a snarl, Cabot grabbed one of the armorback's eye stalks and pulled. The creature screamed as the eye stalk came free in a burst of ichor. It clutched Cabot to it more tightly, but this close, it could not bring its pincers to bear upon him. Cabot ripped out the creature's remaining eye stalk, then began to gouge and kick at its underbelly, the desperate, blind monster unable to stop him. Tesca sagged, his vision fading, his grip failing. Below him, he could just make out the shape of the gig, a slender wedge against the dark water.
Giacomo,
he called out, unable to tell if he was actually making any noise at all. Then his hands opened, and he fell. This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. Also, if you're looking to add another podcast or two to your collection, here's one you might like. For great short stories of literary adventure fantasy, check out the Beneath Ceaseless Skies audio fiction podcast, a 2-time Parsec Award finalist, featuring short stories from the Hugo Award finalist online magazine Beneath Ceaseless Skies. To hear over 100 fantasy stories by authors such as Marie Brennan, Saladin Ahmed, and Richard Parks, read by Parsec Award finalist readers such as Rajan Khanna, Tina Connolly of Toasted Cake, and John Maher, look for Beneath Ceaseless Skies on iTunes or visit beneath-ceaseless-skies.com. And if you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.